Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Velkommen til Finnmarksløpet Pod, a podcast about what else till Finnmarksløpet. I am your host, Casey Groove. Just kidding. Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, it's not about the Finnmark, it's about the Iditarod. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get too carried away, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Well, it's Tuesday. We'll have an update on four-time Iditarod champ Dallas Seavey's foray into Europe's longest dog-mushing race over in Norway. That's coming up. We'll also have a look at our plans for tomorrow, because in the Iditarod, we're into the home stretch, the Nome stretch, if you will. And there was a big shakeup yesterday. Norwegian musher Yor Leifseth Olsom is now leading the 2018 Iditarod and is into White Mountain this morning. That's where he'll take a mandatory 8-hour break. And I'm kind of glad he's stuck there resting for a while, because I feel like every time we drop a new podcast, something crazy happens right afterward. The crazy thing that happened not long after the podcast went out yesterday, and maybe you've picked up on this since I said Olsom is now out front, it's what allowed Olsom to slip into the lead, and it can be blamed on a notoriously fickle part of the Iditarod Trail. Those of us watching the Iditarod's GPS tracker yesterday morning were like, what? How? Why? That's because as the other front-running musher who was leading the race the last several days, Nicholas Petit, was heading north along the Bering Sea coast on the sea ice between Chaktulik and Koyuk, he strayed from the trail. His path meandered east toward the shore, then he doubled back and he refound the marked trail. At the time, the area was getting hit with a strong northerly wind and a ground storm that was severely reducing visibility. Petit told a camera crew from the Iditarod Insider that he thinks his team wandered off toward a previously staked trail, conceding that the trip had been exceptionally hard on him and his team. Petit's error created a window for Olsom to pass by him and reach the Koyuk checkpoint first, nudging Olsom into a lead that many thought had been locked in by Petit. Now, Olsom's runtime between the two communities was a little over 8 hours. Petit's, by contrast, was more than 13. A few hours later, Mitch Seavey arrived in Koyuk posting a 12-hour runtime. Then, Olsom mushed almost nonstop from Koyuk to Elim overnight, and while Petit was only a couple miles behind out of Koyuk, he needed to rest along the way. Olsom then stopped in Elim only a few minutes early this morning, leaving about 1 a.m. Petit rested his team in Elim and was about 3 hours behind Olsom out of that checkpoint. So Olsom checked into White Mountain about 7:50 a.m. today, and he's far enough ahead that after that 8-hour rest, he should be able to pull off his first Iditarod win. But nothing is for certain. Another four-time champ, Jeff King, who we're going to hear from here in a little bit, was going for his fifth win in 2014. That would have tied him with Rick Swenson for the most first-place finishes ever. And King arrived in White Mountain well ahead of the rest of the pack that year. I was covering the race in 2014 for the Anchorage Daily News, and I talked to King in White Mountain. This is what he said.
So, Jeff, how you feeling?
Oh, I feel good. Doesn't seem, you know, I'm not going to try figuring out what color truck I want till I get to Nome or anything. I've been here before. Things are going great. They don't always stay great.
King there in White Mountain in 2014, and what he said proved to be very prophetic. A huge windstorm blew up, and when King was just outside of the safety checkpoint, that's farther down the trail and only 22 miles from the finish line in Nome, the howling wind blew his sled over, tossed him and his dogs around, and he had to take shelter in some driftwood for over 2 hours. Eventually, he got help from some snow machiners and had to scratch from the race. Let me tell you, it was nuts. Dallas Seavey somehow made it past Ali Zirkel and won that year. But he hadn't seen Zirkel or King, and he didn't even know what had happened until a couple minutes after he crossed the finish line. I also recorded this video at the finish line, and in it you can hear one of the Iditarod's videographers ask Seavey if he thought he could have done this.
Heading down.
Dude, Dallas, do you think you could do this?
Huh? What exactly did I do?
You just won the Iditarod 2014.
You kidding me?
Yeah, dude.
No, there's my dad behind me.
Right?
Where's Jeff and Allie?
Behind you.
You hear him say, "What the heck did I do?" He didn't know what had happened. And I have to say, that moment that the video cuts out, that is when my phone died, so I just barely got that captured. In any case, this year, even though Olsen and his team will be rested and well in the lead out of White Mountain on the final 77 miles of Iditarod Trail, if things turn into a life or death situation, a musher could always be forced to pull the plug for the safety of their dogs and themselves. And if Petit is in good enough position to capitalize, and he's able to, you better bet he surely will. Speaking of Dallas a minute ago, as we mentioned yesterday, he's over in Norway competing in a sled dog race called the Finnmark Slopet. He's still in the lead about halfway through that 750-mile race, the longest in Europe. Not competing in the Iditarod this year after controversy over a dog doping scandal, his anger about how the Iditarod handled that. We covered that way back in episode 2 if you want to go back and take a listen for the details. Again, an Alaskan is leading a race in Norway, a Norwegian leading a race in Alaska. Kind of mind-boggling. And whether Olsen or even Petit wins, it would be either musher's first Iditarod championship and the first in 6 years that somebody not named Sivi has won it. Currently, the top of the Iditarod leaderboard is filled with younger mushers, most of them in their 20s and 30s, the race's up-and-comers. Mitch Sivi is the only former champion among the top 20 teams, currently running in third place. Rounding out the somewhat more spread-out chase pack today are, pretty similar to the order they were in yesterday, Ray Reddington Jr., Pete Kaiser, Richie Deal, Travis Beals, and Ramey Smith. Jesse Holmes has moved up to ninth place and is now the top rookie in the race. It'll be really interesting to see if he can hang on or if Matt Hall pulls ahead again and to see who's going to be the rookie of the year. But most of the sport's titans are way farther back, if they're still running at all. And get ready for some more Jeff King. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, many esteemed members of mushing's old guard are content to watch a new generation inherit that mantle.
Usually along the trail, Jeff King has a giant tub of animal crackers. But right now in Unalakleet, surrounded by boxes of snacks, he is liberally enjoying a bag of candy.
I'm eating a couple of peanut butter cups by Reese's before I go up and have a bite in the community center.
King has won the Iditarod 4 times, among innumerable other distinctions in a sport he's helped define for decades. But his drive to win is diminished.
My motto has been, I'm going to get there as fast as I can without rushing. And you know, I just need sleep now I didn't used to need, or at least I'm not willing to go without to keep up with these yahoos. I'm not physically up to it.
As he watches younger mushers stress over minutes lost in their scramble to win, King doesn't feel envy. Instead, it's causing him to re-examine a notorious reputation for competitiveness that came at the expense of a lot else.
There's even part of me on the Yukon watching these guys just go, why are you, and why did I used to feel so compelled to get my dogs to know them faster than your dogs? Who really gives a rip?
Instead, he's approaching the race more philosophically and compares racing his dog team 1,000 miles to his mother growing heirloom tomatoes.
You know, you don't rush it. You plant it, you nurture it, you care for it, and then you monitor the fruit. And in this case, the fruit is the energy and the athleticism of the dogs. But you don't pick the fruit until it's ready.
What King means is that he isn't going to push his dogs or himself for the sake of a race position. And perhaps this sounds familiar. Last year, King sang a similar tune when, early in the race, he was solidly in the middle of the pack, yet sprinted down the coast and seized 11th place. Though he's kept a comfortable pace this year, he's looking forward to speeding down the next few 100 miles. But he insists it has nothing to do with winning. It's just fun to do when you've got a gang line full of ripe tomatoes. A single spot ahead of King is one of his main competitive rivals, Martin Boozer, himself a 4-time champion as well. He's just finished a baggie of muktuk, given to him as a gift, and is on his way inside for a nap. Boozer chuckles, describing his slog over the portage into Unalakleet.
It wasn't any faster than the Yukon. Everything seems like going in slow motion this year.
Boozer is upbeat, but there are notes of melancholy. He's had a little bit of fun this race, but after years of jockeying for first place, he says it's frustrating to have a good team, solid strategy, and familiar routines, yet still be just barely in the top 30.
It's just part of the game, you know. It's just one of the trials and tribulations we have to overcome.
Boozer and King haven't said anything about not running future Iditarods, but that isn't the case for Didi Janro, one of Mushing's most vibrant celebrities. She announced a while back that she'd be retiring from competition, then scratched early in this year's race.
My personal health had gotten to the point where dog care could possibly be compromised, and that's not who I am, that's not who I want to be, and quite frankly, I think I could have been a burden.
Janro flew to Unalakleet to stay with friends, greet peers at the checkpoint, and start enjoying the race from a new vantage point.
I thought it could possibly be kind of sad, wish I was on a team. It is not. It feels good on this end.
Janro says she'd like to spend the next few Iditarods as a volunteer at the checkpoint in Unalakleet. On the Iditarod Trail in Unalakleet, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Zach with some great interviews there back in Unalakleet. He sent us the full audio of his interview with Jeff King. It's about 9 minutes long, and I think I'm going to post it at the end of today's podcast for anybody who'd like to listen to that whole thing. And Zach also got an interview to answer today's listener question. First, the question.
Hello, Iditapod. This is Scott Hastings in Austin, Texas. I logged into the Iditarod GPS tracker, and the leaderboard showed Heidi Sloan with bib number EDU way out in front. Huh? Who is Heidi Sloan, and what is the Teacher on the Trail program? Thanks for the great podcast.
I'm Heidi Sloan. I'm 2018 Teacher on the Trail and in Unalakleet.
And what is the Teacher on the Trail?
They choose one teacher to go on the trail every year to be sort of a reporter-like for kids and teachers all over the world. So I'm writing articles and sending videos to classrooms all over.
How close is this experience to what you expected when you applied and kind of started the process?
I think I've learned a ton more than I could have possibly just watching online or reading. It's just incredible to see the volunteers that make this happen and then just the endurance of the mushers in this weather.
What's stuck with you so far? I mean, what's made a really big impression from the checkpoints you've been to?
I've loved meeting all the villagers and just how they have just embraced me and everyone that's come in. They're just so warm and welcoming, and they're just very excited to have the Iditarod come through.
And what's been your favorite part about the mushers that you've spoken with or gotten to chat with or see come in?
I think when Noah Pereira said, I've had a great time, I'm having so much fun, but I'm so sad I had to leave some of my dogs. They're my buddies. So I loved that.
And where do you teach now?
I teach in Fredericksburg, Virginia, Ferry Farm Elementary.
Shout out to the kids at Ferry Farm Elementary in Virginia, and shout out to the kids in Miss Sarah Thompson's fourth grade class at Riverside Elementary School in Ringle, Wisconsin. They've again been producing their Ikidapod podcast. That's on iTunes competing with us, and this is their third season. We're only on season 2 here at the Iditapod. So nice work, everybody. And nice work to our reporter on the trail, Zach Hughes. He tells me race officials are expecting a first-place finisher early tomorrow morning in Nome, assuming nothing crazy happens, and that could be anywhere between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. We'll have the latest for you here on the Iditapod, maybe even some supplemental coverage after our usual deadline so the pod is hot and fresh. Whatever happens, we'll be back tomorrow with our next episode on the Iditapod. If you haven't already, it's getting close to the end here, but if you haven't already, you can subscribe at iTunes and other podcatcher apps or listen online at alaskapublic.org. We have all the rest of our Iditarod coverage there. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails. Hey, honey, it's me.
Hi.
I have to ask you something.
What?
Do you think it's dumb or a bad idea to pretend like I'm speaking with a Norwegian accent when I introduce the Iditapod today?
No, I wouldn't do that.
Well, it's too late.
What are you eating?
I'm eating a couple of peanut butter cups by Reese's before I go up and have a bite in the community center.
How was the run up the Yukon to Caltag for you?
You know, I made a plan to do it in 3 6-hour runs, and it worked out pretty well. I could tell that I made out of trail most of the way, by myself most of the way. I felt such a big river. You feel so, minimal out there. It's so unimportant, such a big place. But I had a good run, and I've been, I had to drop 3 dogs in each, were some of my top leaders and sentimental favorites. So I haven't been taking it easy, but I have been taking it easy. My motto has been, I'm not going to rush. I'm going to get there as fast as I can without rushing. And you know, I just need sleep now. I didn't used to need, or at least I'm not willing to go without to keep up with these yahoos. I'm not physically up to it. But I do think I can race the last 300 miles. I had fun doing it last year. I let them loose a little this morning to catch up. I'll see if I can have a good run into Nome from here and get there without sleeping much.
When you do race along the coast, are you eyeballing people up ahead of you and trying to leapfrog them, or are you just running your dogs as fast as you can and racing against yourself?
Well, I'm not keeping track of anybody. It's kind of fun because I know that, you know, when you're in 30th place, with a good fast dog team, the odds are you're going to catch a few. But I don't know who they are, and I didn't look, and I'm not trying. That's a big mistake, you know. I'm just going to let them go the same speed, just not as much rest. I'm just positive I'm resting way more than many of the teams in front of me, and for 2 reasons. I want it, and I don't think my dogs would perform very well without it, the way they've been trained. So those guys can do what they're doing and do it in style, then they have dogs who are suited that well. I haven't seen for a while, but kind of fun to watch a race going on up there.
Yeah,
gonna be a good one.
How do you feel when you come down the Unalakleet River and get to the coast? Does it feel different from you than the Portage or the Yukon?
Oh, for sure, and it really has this feeling of, gosh, you're almost there. You know, all of a sudden it's like you're in Nome's neighborhood. And over at Caltag, I don't feel that way. Lord knows I've had some races go sour still from this point in, but for the most part, I feel like, you know, we're headed to Nome in a couple days.
You seem really calm and at ease. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I do feel very calm and at ease. I am not nearly as wound as I know I must have been in years gone by, but there's even part of me on the Yukon watching these guys just go, why did I used to feel so compelled to get my dogs to Nome faster than your dogs? Who really gives a rip? It's fun, as long as it can, you know, stay within the parameters of the dogs. And for the most part, I really like the mushers, the environment. But I really have turned a page where I'm wondering, why is it so important that my dogs, especially when I get back here? That's kind of fun. You know, to see who's got the fastest dog. But if I'm in 34th place, I'm not going to get up from a nap early to get to 33rd place. I mean, just no one, including me, cares. And
You said that last year, and then you slingshotted past like 20 teams.
That was a whole a different reason. I was having a ball. I was not pushing the dogs or myself. And I'll do that again. That is fun. That's like getting on a roll and hitting free throws all day where you just can't miss. And you go, wow, this is really fun. But as soon as, you know, you sprain your ankle or things go sour, then you quit. But I had a weird analogy today. But it made me feel like my mom growing heirloom tomatoes. You know, you don't rush it. You plant it, you nurture it, you care for it, and then you monitor the fruit. And in this case, the fruit is the energy and the athleticism of the dogs. But you don't pick the fruit until it's ready. And, you know, I really feel like, for me, last year and this year, it was just not fair to, I would not have gone well for me to speed up earlier in the race. That I would have, and I had absolutely, I watched one of the young competitors, I don't know if he's even 30 yet, guy I know, been in the race several times, but see him in a McGrath, he'd overslept and he looked like, oh my God, I've lost, you know, minutes or 30 minutes or something, and he's running and putting his clothes on fast, like, oh my God, I'm off my schedule. And you know, inside of me, I'm going, well, number one, I acknowledge it, I recognize that I did it too for years. But now I just said, are you kidding? Go have a cup of coffee and, you know, change your socks and it will all work out. And with that said, this race and other races I've been in have been won by seconds. But if you can turn seconds in McGrath into seconds in Nome, that's a really tough thing to do. What I have found is the most successful policy for me to finish well is to just concentrate on caring for my dogs and making them healthy and strong, healthy and strong, healthy and strong, nurture the heirloom tomato, and somewhere up here I'm going to recognize, oh, it's ready to pick. And whether I was 3 minutes longer, and that's not where the energy is. The energy has got to be to maintaining the dogs, because you make one a mistake with the dogs and you send them home, and or they're tired. And that's why this is fun. And I, you know, even today, my dogs are not as tired as the dogs I'm around, because I didn't run the race the way they did to get here, and I probably have had the benefit of more experience and number of dogs to pick from, so I think I probably have a better team than many of these teams. And now those teams are tired, and you know, last year I thought Hugh Neff was gonna crack his neck when he saw me go by him out on the ice between Shaq Tulik and Koyak. Like, last I knew, you were back at Kalskag. What the hell? And we just dusted him. And so I, you know, I am enough of a boy to enjoy a little sprint race down the street. But anyway.
Jeff, I enjoyed this a lot. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, they got me gabbing, though.
No, great. I prefer chatty Jeff to angry, sleepy Jeff.